Welcome to Mighty Parenting, the podcast with real, raw, and relevant talk about raising teens and parenting young adults. Here are your hosts, Judy Davis and Sandy Fowler.
Welcome to Mighty Parenting, a community where we help you raise teens and parent 20-somethings so they can become happy, successful, and emotionally healthy adults. I am Judy Davis, and I'm here with my co-host, Sandy Fowler, and we love doing this podcast and sharing these great guests with you. And we also love keeping it commercial free. So if that's something that you love and you want to support us in doing that, hop on over to mightyparenting.com/support and see what we have there for you. And today we are talking about a topic that is so much a part of my life, and I am so excited to dig in, and it is parenting through the storm. And I know that so many of you have heard our family's story about navigating the challenges that our family has faced, either with our son's learning disability and me advocating for him when he was younger, all the way through when he got older and dealt with a lot of challenges, mental and behavioral health issues in his college years. And one thing that I know for myself is in doing all of that and researching and trying to get him the help he needed and all of that, it felt so lonely. And I've learned that we weren't alone in that struggle and that loneliness as a parent. There are actually 1 in 5 kids that are affected with emotional and behavioral disorders. And it doesn't matter if it's a learning disability, ADHD, on the spectrum, behavioral health issues. We've talked about all of those things and the challenges they present in our kids. But today we're going to kind of dig in because it's stressful and it affects the entire family. And I know, Sandy, you can talk about that too.
Yeah, again, for new listeners, welcome to the show. If you go back and listen to old episodes, you'll hear Judy and I sharing pieces and you start putting together the picture. But I have a daughter who's neurodiverse. My husband is dealing with anxiety and depression, and he has Asperger's. And it's challenging and it is stressful. It's also beautiful and wonderful when you find your way through that, but it is also something that can feel really lonely. I have been fortunate that I have Judy to talk to. And so at least I always had one person who could get it and who could give me that support. But as we do this work, and as I started opening up my conversations, talking with other parents, there are so many families out there who are struggling through things or who have been through things and are, you know, on that easier, better, happier other side. But the thing that they have in common is that they didn't have other people to talk to because people aren't talking about it, even though it is 1 in 5 families. And it's 1 in 5 kids. So, you know, sometimes right. It's more than 1 in family. But you think about that and just think about how many kids you know and how many people you know. Most families are dealing with this in some capacity. And with the increasing rates of depression and anxiety in our high school kids and our college kids, it's really growing. And that was what really touched me when I saw an interview with today's guest. Her name is Ann Douglas, and she knows, truly knows, just how overwhelming and lonely this can be because she has 4 children, each of whom has struggled with 1 or more mental health challenges. And some of those include bipolar disorder, anorexia, ADHD, Asperger's, and depression. And Anne, being a writer and the author of award-winning parenting books, she took what she knows and she took this opportunity to put pen to paper again or fingers to keyboard again. And she wrote a new book. It's Parenting Through the Storm. And this one is here to provide information and support for parents as they navigate the waters of parenting when dealing with mental or behavioral health issues. So Judy and I, as you can tell, are very interested in this topic, and we are glad that everyone in the Mighty Parenting community is here. And we thank you for joining us in the Mighty Parenting community today.
Oh, I was so thrilled to get your invitation because I immediately went to your website and I thought, these are my kind of people. We're definitely on the same page.
Exactly. Well, let's just jump right in. And in your book, you talk about the reality of what it is to parent a child who's dealing with an emotional behavioral issue. How do we know if that's our kid?
I think that your parent radar sort of alerts you to the fact that maybe your child is having bigger struggles than what you see other people's children having, you know? So I think you sort of pick up on maybe it's the frequency of behavioral eruptions at home. It could be the number of calls from the school. I remember years when it was like, oh man, I don't even know if I want to look at call display as that call comes in because I know it's going to be another call from the school. So you have this sense that your child is struggling more. Maybe it's behavioral stuff. Maybe it's sleep problems. Maybe it's food issues. It could be any number of things, but your gut instinct is just saying, you know what? I think I need to check this out and find out. Maybe there is something here.
So that is something that I think is hard for parents to do, especially in our current culture, because one of the things I've seen in our culture is there's a lot of, me too, and almost one-upmanship. If mm-hmm. you actually do start heading toward bringing up a discussion about, you know, your child and their sleeping issues or their food issues, other parents around have this tendency, it seems like, to go, oh yeah, oh my gosh, oh, I dealt with that and it was so terrible. And there isn't really a true listening or a way to get information that you can compare and go, is mine different? You know, is my kid really have a problem, something that we need some outside help with, or is it just normal teenage stuff?
I think that's a really good point, and I think it can skew either way. You either have people who are almost in competition about that issue where you feel like, well, gosh, I have nothing to complain about. You know, I mean, I've only been losing sleep for 2 years. That other person's been losing sleep for 10 years, you know, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. Or you get people who are petrified of sharing their family's story because they think that somehow it's going to reflect poorly on them or it's going to somehow follow their child. And it's funny because there are actually two different editions of my book. There's a Canadian edition and then there's an American/international edition. And when I started interviewing parents in America, the level of fear was ratcheted up even more than what I'd experienced on the Canadian side of the border. And some people, they basically just wanted to, you know, completely mask their identity because they were petrified that years from now, somebody would connect the dots between, you know, their name and their child's name, and it might affect their child's ability to get into a university or hold down a job or any number of things. And because there is so much parent shaming and judging these days, I could really understand that instinct, that, you know, that desire to, yes, share your experience with other families, but not to do so in a way that would cause harm to yourself or your family or your child, because of course you're fiercely protective of all those people you love.
And judgment is such, I think you're really, really onto something about this whole judgment and fear thing, Anne, because I know when years ago, when we were discovering that our son had dyslexia and dysgraphia and things like that, we even got pushed from the teachers about, he's just lazy. You guys aren't doing what you need to do at home to make him take responsibility and things like that. And while, yeah, maybe there's a little piece of that, the judgment made me turn into Mama Bear. And then I was in this advocacy place of it's me against the school or me against parents who were judging my child or whatever. And what that does is just made me feel more isolated and not sure how to get the support I needed. And so if we find people judging or acting out of fear because our children's behavior or things that are going on, what can we do as a parent?
I think a lot of it comes down to educating the other people and really looking for other people who will support you on your journey. I mean, there are some people that we encountered through either children's rehabilitation, outpatient services, or in the school system who were amazing. Like, I'm thinking about this one sort of resource teacher that worked with early childhood age children, and she guided us through a whole bunch of home therapy that would help my son with his, you know, major speech impediment at the time. And at the end of our program, she wrote this report summarizing, you know, the gains he had made. And she said, you know, in her lovely letter that she attached to this binder of documentation, that, you know, she gave full credit to the parents for working so hard to help bring Ian along and so on. And I don't think she had any idea how much that meant, because I was feeling at the time, I don't know if I'm doing it well enough. What if I can't make a difference for my child? And just to have that validation. And then there was another teacher in the school system who detected the signs of a learning disability in our third child. And she was the one who said, you know, maybe we should do some screening here and so on. And just, she was his champion, because she could see all his good sides and look beyond the anxious acting out in the classroom that was his fear manifested, right? So, So when you have those people, like, I still feel warmness in my heart thinking about these people and some of this stuff that happened was 15 years ago, but yet they made that much of an impact on my parenting and on my children that I'm going to be forever grateful.
I want to dig into that education piece, because so many people make assumptions about what's going on with kids based on their behaviors before they even know the full backstory. And they don't know very much about this emotional and behavioral issues. So can you shed some light on, maybe pick a few and give us some details about how they might show up to educate people, that if they see a child or they see a family that's struggling and there's behaviors that are there, what might they kind of open up their minds to be a little more understanding and accepting, realizing it's not just bad discipline or the kids should know better?
Yes. I think that if the person, and sometimes, you know, it's a family member and sometimes it's somebody at school or in the community, if they can say, you know, what is that child's behavior trying to say? What does that child really need right now? And if you can get to the underlying motivation, it no longer seems like a child, you know, randomly acting out with the sole purpose of driving the adults in the room over the top or pushing people's buttons. It's not about that at all. It's that child reacting out of a place of fear, or that child feeling like they need some support or help that nobody has been able to pick up on. So I think we can be much kinder and more compassionate to kids when we look at it through that lens and think, no child is going to be acting out to that degree just for fun. It's exhausting and they're getting negative feedback from everybody. So what does that child need to begin to make things better? And at the same time, look at the parent behind that child who's feeling equally frustrated, puzzled, overwhelmed, afraid, because maybe every day or every week they're getting a call saying, you have to come to the school, you have to pick up your child, and their life is in chaos. So how can you help to bring down that level of fear and spark communication and conversations that lead to collaboration where everybody works together for the good of that child, as opposed to pointing fingers of blame across the table and saying, it's not my fault, it's your fault?
So with that, you know, a lot of our conversation here is almost a step ahead. We've kind of moved into this realm where we know there's an issue with our child. And, you know, one of the things you told us is follow our gut. If it seems like our child is having more issues than what's normal, if we just feel that there's an underlying reason, then, you know, to follow through with that. Another example you just gave is, you know, you are constantly in contact with the school because your child is having problems or being sent home or acting out or whatever. So those are some indicators that there may be an underlying mental or behavioral health problem. And when we hit that point, we go, well, we think there's something wrong. What can we do? Because I think a lot of times people, we just don't know what to do, or we'll rely on the teacher. And while teachers can be a great ally and they can be someone on that front line observing things, they aren't the expert to tell us what our child is experiencing physiologically.
Right. And they are not allowed to do a diagnosis. So they don't want to get into that, you know, muddy sort of zone where they're beyond their scope of practice. So I think at this point, then you go turn to the professionals who can help you to figure out what's going on. And you, you know, you go talk to your family doctor or your child's pediatrician, or, you know, if you're tapped into some, you know, sort of behavioral support services, those people, and say, this is what we're observing at home. This is what the teacher's observing at school. These are the concerns. Should we be doing some kind of evaluation? Like what could some next steps be? And it could be any number of different things. It could be, you know, we should do a full psychological educational evaluation, or it could be maybe the child would benefit from some coping skills to help deal with anxiety, or any number of different things. But at least then you're beginning to have the discussion and to get some ideas on the table, and to feel like the tremendous sense of relief that comes when you start to feel like other people are helping you with this, and that you're getting some answers, and that it's not bad parenting. I mean, that's what people tell me so often when I either do a presentation or when I was interviewing the parents for the book, to have that sense that, you know what, it wasn't just bad parenting. There was an underlying issue, and now we have a diagnosis, and now we have a game plan, and it's so much more manageable.
It's almost like what you're saying is that if you notice your child is having challenges and issues, you want to become on this gathering data mission, as opposed to beating yourself up and feeling bad about all the things that they should be doing or you should be doing, and all of that expectations of how it should be. Just start gathering all the data. That's an action step that you can do that actually feels good.
It does. It does. And I mean, there are all kinds of tools out there that can help you to sort of, you know, gather this information. And I think just even starting to keep a binder where maybe you jot down things that you've noted day to day, and you have, you know, past medical appointment notes or whatever, because then the pieces of the puzzle come together. I mean, we all think we're going to have brilliant memories, right? But in 5 years from now, you may not remember the name of the person who passed on this useful diagnosis or whatever, and you may need to draw that information from your memory. So give your poor brain a break and write some of this stuff down.
I think that was one of the best things, pieces of advice I got when our son went into recovery and we were trying to get information on what was really going on. And I had all the documentation from when he was diagnosed when he was young. And by having that, it gave the doctors the ammo they needed to actually be able to treat him properly and give him antidepressant meds and anxiety meds and what would really and truly help him move beyond his suicide ideation and everything else. And it was all that data that they were then able to piece together. And it came helpful later in dealing with insurance. You don't even realize knowing who you're talking to, the date, the time, what they said, all of that data is just maybe helpful later. For sure. I love that piece of advice, Anne. Love that.
Well, in Judy's idea there, just when you said go on a data gathering mission, I kind of felt relief, because I think what happened is I went, okay, this isn't an instantaneous thing. I don't have to know everything right now. And then we don't have to fix everything right now. We're going through these steps, through this process of, you know, listening to our gut, observing, trying to figure out, talking to other people, getting recommendations for the various kinds of help available in our area. You know, Anne, you said, you know, talk to your family doctor. And it's not that I necessarily am going to go to my family doctor and say, you know, these are my concerns, I expect you to fix it. It's, these are things we're observing, and you have facts and information that helps the doctor, but you say, what is available? What are our options? And some of those options are also, you know, a more traditionally physical. I have, my daughter had struggled with some anxiety and a depressive episode. And a few years later, I'm watching her and she can't get out of bed, and she's thinking that, you know, there's a problem again. We're thinking that turns out it was just she needed some nutrients. We just needed to do some supplements for a while and to help that out. It was so doing that, but going through that, just like let me feel there was a little time that I didn't have to have the answers right now, that I can start asking other people and take the time to figure out what's really going on. Kind of go into that curiosity, that problem solving mode.
And there's something amazing that happens when you start working through that process, because you realize how much you, the parent, know. Like, you are the world's leading expert when it comes to your child. All these clinicians that you may be consulting with, they're experts in their field, but they don't really know your child the same way. So you can bring invaluable information to the table that either, shortens the number of frustrating things that have to be tried at school, or helps to pinpoint the right medication if you go the medication route or whatever. Like, just, I think sometimes as parents we think, well, what do I know? I'm just the parent. Never frame it that way. Just realize that you are such an important person in the process of helping your child to get to a happier, healthier place.
Having that data when you're talking to other people, being able to say factually, this is what we observed, this is what a teacher observed, this is what our doctor observed, I find that other adults start to listen more carefully and take your observations more seriously.
Yes.
And it also empowers our kids, I think. I know when I'm talking about things and am factual and approaching it as we're solving a problem to find relief for you, my child stops that self-deprecating self-talk and goes, okay, this is something that isn't about me. It's just about something going on within me. It's no different than a sickness. You know, when we do emotional and mental health, so often that stigma around it can transfer onto our kids and they feel like there's something wrong with them. And there isn't. It's just we have to learn how to give them the tools they need. And that's really stressful. So it leads me to my next question for you, Anne, because when we're going through all of this and we're talking to doctors and dealing with our kids and implementing new strategies to help them, while we know in the long run it's going to be helpful, it is really stressful for both myself and my child. Can you talk about that?
Yes, I'm just mentally jumping back in the time machine and sort of going back.
I know, right?
13, 12 years ago, when it seemed like everybody in the family was struggling and we had like endless different layers of appointments, medical appointments. At one point, a couple of kids were going for individual counseling. We were going for family counseling. We were going for couples counseling. I was going for individual counseling because I have bipolar disorder as well and, was trying to manage all that. And I just felt like this is becoming a full-time job, this family stuff. So it can be very overwhelming. And if I could have a conversation with myself of a decade ago, I would have said, like, the thing that the wiser me of today would say is, you just have to take the best possible care of yourself right now, because this is really hard and it's really stressful. And, no pressure, Anne, but you're kind of the glue that's holding the family together, and we can't have you burning out. So maybe I would have, been a little kinder to myself. I learned about self-compassion just a few years ago, and I feel like that's the piece of the puzzle I've been missing all these decades that would have made life so much easier. And if only I could have, from the moment my children arrived, taught them about self-compassion, I think it would have been a different journey for everybody. I don't think we would have avoided some of the road bumps, but maybe we would have eased over them a little more smoothly.
Oh, to take a breath on that one, because you just, I'm stunned in silence because you just spoke to my heart. Like, oh my gosh, so true, so true.
Well, and there was another piece to this is, taking care of yourself is essential, and acknowledging that this is stressful, and it's okay that it's stressful, but we need to find our own personal techniques for releasing and relieving that stress, for, as you said, riding those bumps as smoothly as we can. But I think part of that stress also comes from just the guilt that we can feel as, you know, maybe we're dealing with one child's problems and maybe we have a child who doesn't have as many issues, or we've dealt with their issues. You know, you have one kid who needs more of your time and your attention and things than the others. And there can be guilt with that. Or as a family, when one person is experiencing or multiple people are experiencing issues, it can create dysfunctional patterns within the family. And so I was wondering, Anne, if you can talk to us a little bit about that. Like, how do we recognize if the whole family's having a dysfunctional pattern, and what can we do about that?
I'm smiling to myself because I'm remembering back in the day how initially my husband was really resistant to the idea of going for family counseling when the various counselors began to suggest it, because, you know, really, when one person's having a really hard time, that person may be the one who is like the identified patient, I think they call it, where that's the person who brings the family into counseling, but really the whole family system is thrown out of whack. So back to my dear husband, he's like, you know, I don't know what this counseling's going to do for us. Grump, grump, grump. And now he's like, you know, almost like a counseling evangelist. He will stop people on the street who are having a hard time. Say, the best thing I ever did in my life was when we went for family counseling, and so on. So I think there's, you know, that kind of layer to it. And, just knowing that if you work through some of these things as a family, you can learn how to relate to one another in healthier ways. I mean, you do get into patterns. Like when our daughter had her eating disorder, we were often reacting out of fear, and we weren't necessarily setting the limits, the healthy limits that she needed, because we were terrified. So, you know, you need an outside person to help sometimes guide you through some of these bad, I guess, ruts you've gotten yourself into over the years. Not through any fault of your own, but because you're human and you're terrified.
And especially when it comes to emotional and behavior health problems, I think fear is paramount to any other feeling. I know for us, that was true. Even to this day, 6 years, and my son has been in recovery. You know, he's now 25 years old and he's been in recovery for 6 years. There's still the fear if I hear a tone in his voice, and he lives down in Texas and I'm here in Seattle. You know, it's interesting that fear guides our parenting so often when we're dealing with mental, emotional, and behavioral issues. And I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, but it just seems interesting to me.
Yeah, I think you're totally bang on. And I think there's almost like, you know, circles of fear, because it could be, you know, I'm afraid that I'm letting my child down. And then I'm afraid that this worrisome look that I just saw on my child's face means that things are going south again, and so on. So sometimes I find that you have to almost face like the worst case scenarios, the what ifs that happen, and think, you know, that you can get through some really hard stuff. I mean, we had a house fire a couple of years ago. I mean, sometimes I feel like our family could be like a movie of the week, but anyway, it was this awful moment where, you know, a car in our driveway caught on fire. It wasn't our car. It was a friend's car, and it set our house on fire, and we got $150,000 worth of damage to our house, and we had to live in a hotel for 2 months. But what that taught me is you are able to, when you've been through previous really scary stuff, to sort of cut to the chase. Because I think like Joe Average on the street, if they had a house fire, you know, they'd be completely flipped out. Well, we looked at each other and we said, you know, house is still standing. It's a little bit charbroiled, but it's still there. Nobody died. The baby photos are fine. So really, it's just, you know, upheaval and inconvenience for the next 2 months, which it was. So I think that we don't often give ourselves credit for the coping capacity and the resilience we build up as individuals and as family members as a result of having had these experiences. And now I'm not saying anybody on the planet wants to volunteer to have a child with a mental health problem in order to build coping capacity. But if you are given that experience by life and you come out the other side, you have such an appreciation of the gift of those children, and you have such an appreciation of your ability to get through life's storms. So, you know, if your house does catch on fire, you know you'll get through it because you've been through a lot worse.
There is definitely that. And I just wanted to take a moment and talk about supporting our child as they're going through this, especially those teen years, and, you know, the leaving the nest, in, you know, 18, 20, during those times, do you have any particular advice for parents as we hit those turbulent times, and what is especially helpful?
I think to realize that you can't sort of like have a remote control device that's going to control your child remotely, even though you feel like so much you want to do that. And that, you know, sometimes it's easy when you've had prior worrisome experiences with your child to assume that any act of sort of, you know, falling off the rails is evidence that things are going to go south again really quickly, when really it may just be normal adolescent stumbles. So it's about figuring out when to worry and when to worry a little less. I don't think I've ever figured out the don't worry at all setting in my brain.
Right.
I have that setting, but just learning how to take a deep breath when your child says they've had a car accident or whatever, and, you know, sort of pulling yourself together and moving on. And I think also parents today get so criticized, and I think so unfairly, for being helicopter parents. And parents in our situation, we have to be a little more hands-on than perhaps your average parent. And it makes me so mad when I hear people getting criticized or feeling guilty for really just being healthy, committed, and connected parents. And I just wanted to make two points on this front. First of all, there's tons of evidence to show that sort of college and university age students do really well when they have involved parents who are sort of, you know, supporting them behind the scenes, not making decisions for them, but providing age appropriate support. And adults, the parents themselves, do better during that bizarre midlife experience where, you know, your nest is getting empty and emptier, when they themselves have healthy ongoing relationships with their young adult children. So why on earth we have to get all these mean messages in the media telling us we're doing it wrong for being loving and connected parents? It makes me shake my head so much.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that it is a challenge to do it as a blanket statement.
Yes.
Because what you said was healthy, committed, and connected parents. And there are still a lot of parents who are, you know, calling their college kids to wake them up for class, or calling the professor for their college student. And with the caveat that, like you said, parents in these situations, there may be, if we have a child who is experiencing additional difficulties, it could be appropriate to do that. If you have a child in college with Asperger's, they may not be able to fully communicate with the professor. It might be appropriate to be there with them physically or verbally and helping coach them through it. But in general, I think it's that difference between taking the reins and doing for them, as opposed to what you said, which is being that healthy support, being in connection with them. Judy, we've talked about this before, that
right.
You know, your kids still will be in connection with you several times a week, sometimes your daughter every day.
Yeah, we do. But it's not in that enabling way.
Mm-hmm.
It truly, we took our relationship to a different place.
Yeah.
And we find that balance that is healthy. And I'm not intrusive or judging on her life. I mean, she has babies of her own, you know. I am there as a support system, as a sounding board that knows her positives and struggles and challenges and all the things that make her the beautiful person that she is. And I'm able to be a sounding board for her where other people wouldn't have the data that I do. So it's that finding that way to help and empower our kids without holding them back and taking over or living vicariously through them. I think that that's the key.
And that listening to your gut piece again. Different kids need different amounts of support depending on their personal situation. And you told us that we are the expert on our kids. So we just need to ask ourselves, am I doing this for my child or am I doing it for myself?
Right, exactly. And just, you know, have that little check where, you know, at this stage of development, I do ideally they want to be learning how to stand on their own feet, and it's not always a straight line. I mean, there can be little stumbles backwards, and some kids really need a lot more reassurance than others, but you can push back in healthy ways. Like, I remember when our daughter was trying to decide if she should go back to college again. She went to university and then she wanted to do some additional training. She kept saying, "What do you think?" And I said, "It doesn't matter what I think, it's what you think that matters." And you know, make yourself a pros and cons list and we can talk through those, but I will not make this decision for you. And part of it was like, I don't want to be the one who gets blamed 5 years right. from now if I make the wrong decision. So, you know, I'm backing away from that one. Thank you.
I do that a lot with one of mine. I'm like, I'm not making this call because it's coming back at me.
Yep.
Exactly.
All right. Well, I would love to continue this, but I'm going to wrap us up here. And I just want to go back and hit a few high points and remind us of some of the key things that we shared today. And Anne, I love, you know, you've led us this place of just being parent who is there and is trusting our gut. And so you said our parent radar can alert us to the fact that our child is dealing with something that's bigger than typical. And it can be challenging because there is a lot of parent shaming and judging out there, but we just need to start gathering data, paying attention to what's going on, asking other people what they're observing, and putting that info in a binder was a big suggestion and total spot on. Judy's in love with that idea, so we're pushing that one. But start collecting that information and putting it in a binder, and then start reaching out. If you feel that your child could be dealing with something that is physiological, that is contributing to other concerns, other issues, mental and behavioral health issues, then reach out. Reach out to your family doctor. Reach out to other experts in your area, because there are tons of resources and help out there. It's not just a checkup or therapy. There are many other things as well, and those two things come in to play a big part in there. And along the way, we need to take the best possible care of ourselves that we can. Just besides the fact that just as a human being, that's something we need to do. It's our right and our privilege to do that. If for no other reason, do it for your family. Because you're right, Anne, we are the glue typically that holds our families together. Whoever, whatever parent, especially a stay-at-home parent, they are going to be that glue there. And to realize that what's going on doesn't just start, end, and affect one person in the family, that they can just be the catalyst that brings the family into counseling, into a greater awareness, that as we're going through life and as we're going through these things, that we do need an outside person to help guide us out of some of the ruts, some of the dysfunctional behaviors that we have, not only individually, but as a family. And to take a deep breath, because fear is paramount, especially in mental behavioral health issues. And fear can start guiding our parenting, and we don't want to do that. And remember that as our kids are growing up, what we want to be is a healthy, committed, and connected parent, and to give our child the level of support that they need. This is great conversation, and your book is so chock full of just, it's that supportive, feel-good piece, but information and advice. And as you said, you collected stories. So for anyone who's going, you know, I want more from Anne, or I'd like to take a look at that book, where can they find that?
I actually have a website for the book with a bunch of other resources and a blog and so on, because you have to do that when you're an author nowadays. People could just go to annedouglas.net, and that's ANNDOUGLAS.net.
Perfect. Perfect. Well, thank you so much for joining us today and being part of the Mighty Parenting community, Anne. And if it's your first time listening, welcome. We want to invite you to go to mightyparenting.com for resources and information that will help you raise your teens and parent your 20-somethings. If you're a longtime listener, thanks for coming back. We love having you here and listening to people like Anne that share such great information with us. And want to remind you that you are a mighty parent. This is Judy Davis and Sandy Fowler saying see you next week.